Blog Talk Radio.
Howdy, boo. Welcome to Homemade Business 101. My name is Isaiah. I have the pleasure of introducing the host. You know him. He's everybody's hero, my best friend. Will you please join me in welcoming my granddaddy, Baba Jahi?
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Isaiah. And again, good morning, listening audience out there. Hey, you know, you're listening to Home-Based Business 101, and we're celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King weekend this weekend. And I want to thank the 27,005 listeners. That's 27,005 of you have, come past this way and have listened to a broadcast or a show that we have done here on Home-Based Business 101. And we want to thank you so much. And I want to thank several of my co-hosts who are doing shows here on the Home-Based Business 101 platform. Yesterday we had debut of the MLM View with Miss Ruth Bradford. Tonight, you know, we have the New Yorker again with Gail Walker. And then, you know, on Fridays we have the Jasari's Love Show with Mama Jahi. And, hey, this morning, you know, Sundays, I do my show, The Gospel of Working from Home. And today, you know, I'm going to be focusing on Martin Luther King Jr. And, you know, I'm excited to be able to deal with that topic as we chime in this Sunday morning. And I just want to thank again all of the people for tuning in and say to everybody, happy Martin Luther King weekend. And, you know, some people, well, you know, I thought your platform is business. You know, it is business, you know, and this is serious business too, because nothing happens in isolation. Everything happens within context. And so it's important that as we build our businesses and as we look at how to work from home and move forward, is that we understand that we live within a social context and that we need to deal with issues concerning that social context environment that we live in. And so today I want to talk about Martin Luther King Jr. that a lot of people don't know. You know, and it's important that we know the whole man in terms of his views and the things and the issues that he was working on. Too often the mass media just gives us Martin Luther King, I have a dream. And that's a great speech. That speech was given in 1963, but King evolved like we all do. I mean, we don't stay in suspended animation. We all evolve. I mean, from 1963 to 1968, the year he was assassinated, April 4th, on 1968, they ask ourselves, well, you know, what did he do? Was he from 1963 to 1968, was he still walking around giving the same speech every day? I don't think so. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive into part of his book that he wrote, the last book that he wrote, which was titled Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? And this book was written, he started on it around 1965, as he was putting things together, and he finished the manuscript, you know, around 1967. The book got published. When it got published after he was assassinated. So sort of like Malcolm X, Malcolm X autobiography, you know, with Alex Haley, Malcolm X's autobiography got published after he was assassinated. Well, this is one of King's masterful works because the book really, you know, it opens up a lot in terms of getting to really understand King's views on the issues concerning America. And so, you know, in 1967, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. isolated himself from the demands of the civil rights movement. He rented a house in Jamaica with no telephone and labored over his final manuscript. And this important work, which has been unavailable for more than 10 years, that's right, it's been unavailable for more than 10 years. I'm glad Beacon Press, you know, republished this book. We find King's acute analysis of American race relations and the state of the movement after a decade of civil rights efforts. King lays out his thoughts, plans, and dreams for America's future, including the need for better jobs, higher wages, decent housing, and quality education. And we're gonna bring some of these things into context of where we are today in 2010. I don't want to jump ahead of myself. Let me finish moving on with this part right here. Today, as African American communities stand to lose more wealth than any other demographic during this economic crisis, King's call for economic equality and sustainability is especially pertinent. With a universal message of hope that continues to resonate, King demanded an end to global suffering, asserting that humankind for the first time has the resources and the technology to eradicate poverty. This is what he was saying in 1968, that, you know, the resources exist to eradicate poverty, Let me give you some of the chapters, the title of the chapters of the book, and then I'm going to go into some of the introduction, and I'm so glad that they got Vince Harding, who was a comrade of King's and a colleague of mine, to write the introduction of the book. But here are the chapters. The chapters are, Where Are We? Next chapter is Black Power. Next one is Racism and the White Backlash. Next chapter is The Dilemma of the Negro American. Next chapter is Where Are We Going? Next chapter is The World House. Then next is Programs and Prospects. And then notes. And, of course, you know, it's no way we're going to tackle the whole book today on this show. But it's important that, you know, I want you to know the chapters. I want you to know the book. You can purchase the book. I'll put up a link later on where you in the chat room how you can purchase the book. The book is just recently came back out. And so the book has been out of print. A lot of people don't, you know, haven't read the book. I won't say don't read it, but, you know, a lot of people haven't read the book. So a lot of people didn't know the book existed. You know, again, the mass media has done a great job in keeping us and keeping Dr. King locked in 1963, I Have a Dream. And, I mean, even with that speech, we need to, you know, we should break that down. You know, basically, you know, and I'm not going to go into that whole speech, but King came to Washington and he said, you know, we came to cash a check that had bounced, and that America was bankrupt. You know, hey, yeah, he had a dream about change, but he was also calling it like it was, that America was bankrupt, and that being bankrupt, you know, that America, you know, needed to be able to, take and deal with that bad check that it had wrote us. And so remember, the people, when they marched in 1963, they marched for what? For jobs, decent housing. You know, hey, ain't too much change today, you know, and the plight that I see of the poor today is tremendously, what can I say? But anyway, let's get into our topic and, so that I don't get to ranting on here, you know, because I want to stay focused, because I can get very emotional about this topic and also very emotional about Dr. King and the things that he stood for. And so, you know, in the introduction of this, the new print of the book, the Beacon Press release, as I said, Vince Harding, who has, you know, some tremendous works out there that he's written, you know, who also was involved in the movement. And Vince starts off the introduction with saying, having shared a precious friendship with Martin King during the last 10 years of his life, I was very pleased to learn that Beacon Press was returning to its important role as a publisher of his book. Then when I was asked to write the introduction for this new edition of King's fourth book, many powerful memories flooded my being. First and most important was my recollection of how determined Martin was to be fully and creatively engaged with the living history of his time, a history he did so much to help create, but also a dangerous and tumultuous history that shaped and transformed his own amazingly brief yet monumentous searching life. From this position of radical engagement it would have been relatively easy for King if he chose to confine his published writing to telling the powerful stories of the experiences he shared almost daily with the magnificent band of women and men and children who worked in the black-led Southern Freedom Movement, recounting how they struggled to transform themselves, their communities, this nation, and our world. Instead, going beyond the stories, King insisted on constantly raising and reflecting on the basic question he posed in the first chapter of his work: where are we? And in the overall title of his book, where do we go from here? Chaos or community? Always present, of course, were the deeper questions of all. Who are we? And who are we meant to be? See, King, you know, he put forth these questions, you know, and then as he put forth the questions, he challenged himself to dialogue with history. See, we need to understand how history unfolds, and that, you know, and as Vince so eloquently says, you know, that Martin wanted to make sure that we understood living history. You know, history's not abstract. We make it by what we do or what we don't do. And he said he could have very easily just told stories of marches and, hey, we marched here and so-and-so showed up. And, you know, and we challenged the people on this issue. But what he did was he wanted to put it within the context of the bigger picture. Where are we going? You know, what are we looking for as an outcome? You know, and as being a grant writer, you know, one of the things, the first thing I had to learn, you know, I used to do when I first started writing grants was measurable outcomes. You know, I used to write all of this nice stuff about a program and, you know, what you can, and, you know, and we get rejected. And I'm like, you know, why they don't like my proposal? And when I took a tender to the workshop, they said, because you can't show people what the outcomes are and how you're going to measure them. And so King, you know, he challenged this society and challenged things. He was always looking for measurable outcomes so he could keep, as Jesse Jackson says today, so he could keep hope alive. See, one of the things that Martin Luther King talked about a lot, and one of the things that one of the biggest lessons I learned from him is that you can't build on despair. You got to keep hope alive, no matter how bleak it looks. You don't build on despair. You build on hope, eternal hope, you know, eternal hope that without hope, you know, it's hard, you know, just trust me on this one, y'all. If you are leading people, I don't care if it's in a community event, if it's a business event, if you want to motivate people, you better talk about hope. If you start talking about despair, people going to be like, well, what's the point? Why should I even bother to do anything? So you have to, you know, and so Martin was this person that always, you know, wanted to keep eternal hope out there. You know, and the thing is which is important, as Vince goes on in this wonderful introduction to the book, you know, he talks about, indeed, it was the urgent need for self-examination and deep reflection on the new American world that he, Martin Luther King, and the Freedom Movement hoped helped to create that literally drove King to wrestle publicly and boldly with the profound issues of this book. Ironically, it was almost immediately after the extraordinary success of the heroic Alabama voter registration campaign, which led to Selma, to Montgomery marches, and the follow-up of congressional practice of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, that King realized he had to confront a very difficult set of emerging realities that demanded the best prophetic interpretation and his most creative proposals for action. And we're going to go into this first chapter here of the book that deals with that. Again, you can get this book, and I will post a link here in the chat room before we finish so that you can know how to order the book. It's out by Beacon Press, and I'll give you a link of where you can go and order The book is called Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community by Dr. King. It's his last written words in terms of a book. And so, you know, again, you know, read what the man said, what he wrote, not what other people try to tell you what he said, not the words that other people put in his mouth. You know, and I always say, if you want to hide something from people, put it in a book. You know, comedian Chris Rock, you know, he always says that if you're going to keep money in your house and you don't want a burglar to get it, stick it in a book, in your bookcase, because a burglar breaks in, and I guess we've been told now the secret of where money is hidden in the house, and so burglars will probably start looking in now. But, you know, I don't know if any of me burglars listen to my show. But anyway, Chris always makes a joke out of this. He says, because people are breaking your house. He said, they ain't touching the books. He said, books is like kryptonite to them. You know, like kryptonite is to Superman. It scares people. It disempowers some people. But as I always share with my children, when you open a book up, it's like looking at a bird with its wings. When you open a book up and dive into a book, it'll help you soar and fly above the rest. So that's, again, you know, my little note here on why it's important to read and, you know, to tie in to understand and reading. But let's dive into this first chapter because we, you know, we don't have time to go over the whole book. And so I want to, you know, take some of these things out of this first chapter and then at the same time put it into the context of the day, because in Vince Harding's introduction, he does some comparison contrast between King and Obama, because, again, the book was republished in 2010, and so we had a chance to, you know, see, make some statements like, are we going to be able to see the brilliance of Obama, which we saw the other night in terms of his speech, for those of you that had a chance to see his speech, the brilliance of Obama and the brilliance of King. If those two spirits can merge, and where can that take us? Okay, chapter one, where are we? And this is Dr. King's words, and I'm going to be reading from the book and then making my own little comments here as I go through it. On August 6, 1965, the president's room in the Capitol could scarcely hold the multitude of white and Negro leaders crowding it. President Lyndon Johnson's high spirits were marked as he circulated among the many guests whom he had invited to witness an event he confidently felt to be historic, the signing of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The legislation was designed to put the ballot effectively in Negro hands in the South after a century of denial by terror and evasion. The bill that lay on the polished mahogany desk was born in violence of Selma, Alabama, where stubborn sheriffs handled Negroes in Southern tradition had stumbled against the future. During a nonviolent demonstration for voting rights, the sheriffs had directed his men in tear gassing and beating the marchers to the ground. That's that Emmett Pettus Bridge, you know. If you ever see footage of that, you know, they was on horses. They trampled people down as people marched for the right to vote. The nation had seen and heard and exploded in indignation. In protest, Negroes and whites marched 50 miles through Alabama and arrived at the state capital, Montgomery, in a demonstration 50,000 strong. President Johnson, describing Selma as a modern Concord, addressing a joint session of Congress before a television audience of millions, he pledged that we shall overcome and declared that the national government must by law ensure to every Negro his full rights as a citizen. The Voting Rights Bill of 1965 was the result. In signing the measure, the president announced that today is a triumph for freedom as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield. Today we strike away the last major shackle of fierce and ancient bonds. 1 year later, some of the people who had been brutalized in Selma, who were present at the Capitol ceremonies, were leading marches in suburbs in Chicago amid a rain of rocks and bottles, among burning automobiles, to a thunder of jeering thousands, many of them waving Nazi flags. I'm going to go into this and put some of this in the context. I go through some more of this in a minute, to how excited all of us was to get Obama in office, and then we got the Tea Party and what's going on now, and then the violence that is emerging, and you know, we just witnessed it with the shooting of the the congressperson, and, you know, again, we pray for her health and her recovery. But let's look at now, and then let's look at then. As Dr. King said in 1965, after the Voting Rights Act was passed and people was happy that, you know, black people going to be able to vote, you know what I mean? And we had been wanting the right to vote after the Civil War with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. It was 1965 our people was fighting to get an act passed called the Voting Rights Bill. You know, and the thing that's amazing about this Voting Rights Bill is every year it has to be renewed. And if they don't be renewed, we're going to lose those rights that we had to vote. We need to really analyze this, okay? But King talks about a year later. 1 year later, 1966, they're going to Chicago. You know, hey, we're going to Chicago. We're going up to Chicago to deal with the terrible housing conditions that black people were living under. You know, not only black people, but poor people, period, because Dr. King was a champion for all people. And just that, again, the majority of people he was seeking to help was his own people, but he was a champion for all people. And he says they get to Chicago, and they get rocks and bottles thrown at them, burning automobiles, and people waving Nazi flags. Yeah, you know, I know about a place in the suburbs of Chicago called Cicero. You don't go through Cicero, not even today, in 2010. So let's keep it real about how America is. He said a year later, you know, some of the Negro leaders who had been present in summer and at the Capitol summers no longer held offices in their organizations. They had been discarded to symbolize a radical change of tactics. A year later, white backlash had become an emotional electoral issue in California, Maryland, and elsewhere. In several southern states, men long regarded as political clowns had become governors or only narrowly missed an election. Their magic achieved with a witch's brew of bigotry, prejudice, half-truths, and whole lies. What did we just see in the off-year elections? Here in North Carolina, the Tea Party took out a couple of people. We got Sarah Palin running around with sniper lens, you know, kind of things on a map on who needs to be taken out. Boys, is things looking so familiar, you know? And it's, again, that's why it's important to read so we can understand the historical context in which things happen. You hear what Dr. King said a year after the Voting Rights Act was passed. He said people that were political clowns had become governors. We got some political clowns that just got elected in the off-year, you know, they call the off-year elections. And then what was the whole thing? The whole issue of the Tea Party and other people. We want our country back. We're taking our country back. Like, who took it from them? Ain't nobody take the country from them. So, you know, again, that's, you know, Dr. King's book, I mean, woo, it just helps you with reading that time and then understanding that time. He says, during the year, white and Negro civil rights workers had been murdered in several southern communities. The swift and easy acquittals that followed for the accused had shocked much of the nation, but sent a wave of unabashed triumph through southern segregationist circles. Many of us wept at the funeral service for the dead and for democracy. During the year, in several northern and western cities, most tragically in Watts, young Negroes had exploded in violence. In an irrational burst of rage, they had sought to say something, but the flames had blackened both themselves and their oppressors. You remember 1965, Watts, and then in Detroit and other places, the country went up in smoke. Say people called them riots, but they were urban rebellions because people were frustrated. And Dr. King said, what were they frustrated about? The disappointments of these promises. And I'm just saying, hey, people, we're sitting on a counter peg right now. You know, there's tremendous disappointments going on in this country. And, you know, we cannot let the Tea Party and these people today have their backlash like the backlash that we witnessed in the 1960s after the Voting Rights Act was passed. So we got to keep hope alive, as Jesse Jackson says today. And, you know, he really got that from Dr. King. Dr. King always talked about building on hope and not despair. King goes further on in this first chapter. He says, a year later, Ramparts magazine was asserting after more than a decade of the civil rights movement, the black American in Harlem, Haynesville, Baltimore, and Bugalusa is worse off today than he was 10 years ago. The movement's leaders know it, and it's the source of their despair. The movement is in despair because it's been forced to recognize the Negro Revolution as a myth. Remember now, you know, Martin Luther King and people at that time were talking about the Negro Revolution, and you know, Malcolm X was very critical of that. He said, you know, you can't have a revolution in which the goal was to desegregate a lunch counter, a revolution in which you love your enemy. You know, I mean, Malcolm was very critical of what was being called the Negro Revolution. And what happened, we saw that, you know, the bills were passed, but they couldn't be enforced. Had Negroes fumbled the opportunities described by the president? Was the movement in despair? Again, I'm reading from Dr. King's book. Was the movement in despair? Why was widespread sympathy for the Negro Revolution abruptly submerged in indifference in some quarters or banished by outrage, hostility in others? Why was there ideological disarray? A simple explanation holds that Negroes rioted and watched. The voice of black power was heard through the land, and that the white backlash was born. The public became infuriated and sympathy evaporated. This pat explanation founders, however, on the hard flanders, however, on the hard fact that change in mood had preceded Watts in the black power slogan. Moreover, the white backlash had always existed underneath and sometimes on the surface of American life. You hear what Dr. King said in 1965? The white backlash has always existed underneath and sometimes on the surface of American life. Just like we're seeing the white backlash today. I mean, you know what, you know, people, I mean, I had somebody tell me, you know, when I was out at last election here, you know, getting people registered to vote and dealing with the polls. You know, and I was passing out flyers for people to vote, you know, and this white person came up to me, told me, you know, their opinion about certain things, and he said, you know, his closing remark was, it's called the White House, not the Black House, and we're going to get that boy out of there. See, you know, Dr. King, he let us know that, you know, that the white backlash has always existed underneath and sometimes on the surface of American life. No, the answers are both more, this is again going back to Dr. King's book, no, the answers are more, both more complex and for the long run less pessimistic. With Selma and the Voting Rights Act, one phase of the development of the Civil Rights Revolution came to an end. I wonder what phase that was Dr. King was talking about. I'm going to read that sentence again. He said, with Selma and the Voting Rights Act, one phase of development in the Civil Rights Revolution came to an end. He said a new phase opened, but few observers realized it or were prepared for its implications. See, a new phase opened. And just like a new phase, we got Obama in, but a new phase opened, and, you know, we got work ahead of us. Let me get back to Dr. King's book here. For the vast majority of white Americans, the past decade, the first phase, had been a struggle to treat the Negro with a degree of decency, not of equality. A degree of, you hear what he said, of decency, not equality. White America was ready to demand that the Negro should be spared the lash of brutality and, of course, degradation. But it had never been truly committed to helping him out of poverty, exploitation, or all forms of discrimination. I mean, this is Dr. King's words. See, I mean, y'all got to go read the book. He said white America was ready to demand that the Negro should be spared the lash of brutality and coarse degradation. But he said white America had never been truly committed to helping him out of poverty, exploitation, or all forms of discrimination. The outraged white citizen had been sincere. Check this out. He said, had been sincere when he snatched the whips from the Southern sheriffs and forbid them more cruelties. But when this was to a degree accomplished, the emotions that had monumentally inflamed him melted away. White Americans left the Negro on the ground in devastating numbers and walked off with the aggressor. See, now again, go read the book. I'm not putting words in Dr. King's mouth. See, and that's why I said, you know, there's a Dr. King that a lot of people don't know, don't want to deal with, because the mass media gives us, I have a dream, And again, it was a great speech. I'm not knocking that speech. It was a great speech for the social time and context that it came in, 1963. And Dr. King in his book is telling us here after the Voting Rights Act was passed and other things, and he wrote this book, this last book, his piece he wrote and put out here, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? Is that, you know, he's sensing this. We're going to have chaos or are we going to have community? Are we going to be able to come together? Going further in Dr. King's book here, he said, it appeared that the white segregationists and the ordinary white citizen had more in common with one another than either had with the Negro. Again, that's what Dr. King said, not Baba Jahi. He said, it appeared that the white segregationists and the ordinary white citizen had more in common with one another than either had with the Negro. When Negroes looked for the second phase of realization of equality, they found that many of their white allies had quietly disappeared. The Negroes of America had taken the president, the press, and the pulpit at their word when they spoke in broad terms of freedom and justice. But the absence of brutality and evil is not the presence of justice. To fight off murder is not the same as to ordain brotherhood. The word was broken, and freedom-running expectations of the Negro crashed into the stone walls of white resistance. The result was havoc. Negroes felt cheated, especially in the North, while many whites felt that Negroes had gained so much it was virtually impudent and greedy to ask for more or so on. It is like today people say, what do you black people want? We gave you this, we gave you that. Wow, we gave you, you don't need no more. See, I mean, again, this is so, I mean, you know, when I sat and read this last night, you know, and thinking about today's show and putting this information out here, you know, I was like, I said, you know, this, you got to do this, Baba Jahi, because, you know, people don't read and they're not reading and, you know, they don't take the time to sit down to read. And I really want people to get into this because it'll help you understand what we're going through today and you won't be shocked at what you see. But again, you know, we're going to talk about some hope, too, on here in the end. But what we need to do to challenge this stuff, because we don't want to leave here in despair now. But again, you know, as Dr. King said, you know, people felt that black people, we asking too much. We gave you the Voting Rights Act, you know, and y'all know how they talk. You know, I don't use that word on this show. They probably say, you know, with the N-word, you N's want too much. You know, hey, back off, boy. The path of Negro-white unity that had been converging across at Selma and like a giant X began to diverge. Up to Selma, there had been unity to eliminate barbaric conduct. Beyond it, unity had been based on the fulfillment of equality. In the absence of agreement, the past began to move apart. Why is equality so much avoided? Why does white America delude itself, and how does it rationalize the evil it retains? Again, Dr. King, he writes in such a prophetic way. You know, he poses questions, and then he answers questions. As Vince Harding said in the introduction, he could have just as easily just told you about the things that they was doing, and hey, we met at such and such place. No, he's challenging us, and he's challenging America to go beyond where we're at so that we can make this a better place. The majority of white Americans consider themselves sincerely committed to the justice for the Negro. They believe the American society is essentially hospitable to fair play, to steady growth toward a middle-class utopia embodying racial harmony. But unfortunately, and check out what Dr. King says right here, but unfortunately, this is a fantasy of self-deception and comfortable vanity. Overwhelmingly, America is still struggling with contradictions. It has been sincere and even ardent in welcoming some change, but too quickly apathy rises to the surface when the next logical steps are to be taken. See, we can't let people get apathetic, as Dr. King is saying. Laws are passed in a crisis mood after Birmingham or Selma, but no substantial fervor survives the formal signing of legislation. The recording of the law in itself is treated as the reality of the reform. This limited degree of concern is a reflection of inner conflict, which measures cautiously the impact of any change on the status quo. As the nation passes from opposing extremist behavior to the deeper and more passive elements of equality, white America reaffirms its bonds to the status quo. It had contemporarily comfortably hugging the shoreline, but now fears that the winds of change are blowing it out to the sea, just like we see today with these Tea Party people. I'm telling you, folks, you know, we got to know our history. We got to see, you know, what's going on. I mean, you know, hey, you know, I got, you know, some people put some nice comments in the chat room. Yeah, again, Katrina, you know, as people talked about that and being a person that went through Hurricane Katrina, you know, the government had already declared New Orleans a disaster area before the storm hit. The mayor, Mayor Nagin, did not have the power to even declare an evacuation. They had to change the legislator after Katrina, but he didn't even have the power. He should have just went on and did it anyway, people said. But he didn't have the power to do that. He could have commandeered buses to get people out. Some people wanted to commandeer some buses and got people out, and then later on was charged with a crime. You know, so, you know, again, when we put things in context, we need to, you know, go through this book and really, you know, again, the book that I'm going through is Dr. King's last work. Where do we go from here? Chaos or community? And, you know, this is a great, great book to read. I'm going through the first chapter. Because I really want you to get the book and go through the other chapters. The first chapter is Where Are We? Second chapter, Black Power. Third chapter, Racism and the White Backlash. Next chapter, Dilemma of the Negro Americans. Next chapter is Where Are We Going? Next chapter is The World House. The next chapter is Programs and Prospects, and then Notes. And Vince Harding, again, you know, who spent last 10 years of with Dr. King before Dr. King was assassinated, writes the introduction. And he, you know, in the introduction, he puts out some things concerning Obama and Dr. King and hoping that, that we can see a bridge of that. I want to get through a little bit more of this first chapter, so I'll be ready to do my wind-up and then tell you how you can get a copy of the book. He said, the practical cost of change for the nation up to this point has been cheap. The limited reforms have been obtained at bargain rates. Woo, Dr. King talking in business terms here. You know, he said, hey, to pass the bill, you know, to sign an act, he said, that was cheap. You know, it had been obtained at bargain rates. He said, there are no expenses and no taxes are required for Negroes to share lunch counters, libraries, parks, hotels, and other facilities with whites. Even the psychological adjustment is far from formidable. Having exaggerated the emotional difficulties for decades when demands for new conduct become inescapable, white Southerners may have trembled under the strain, but they did not collapse. Even the more significant changes involved in the voter registration required neither larger monetary nor psychological sacrifice. Spectacular turbulent events that dramatized the demand, created an enormous impression that a heavy burden was involved. The real cost lies ahead. The stiffening of white resistance is a recognition of that fact. The discontent education given Negroes will in the future have to be purchased at a full price if quality education is to be realized. Jobs are harder and costlier to create than voting rolls. The eradication of slums and housing millions in complex far beyond integrating buses and lunch counters. The assistant director of the Office of Economic Opportunity, Hyman Bookbinger, in a frank statement on December 29, 1966, and again I'm reading from Dr. King's book, declared that the long-range costs of adequately implementing programs to fight poverty, ignorance, and slums will reach $1 trillion. That was $1 trillion in 1966. I don't know what it would be today. He said, as simple as this, the poor can stop being poor if the rich are willing to become even richer at a slower rate. Furthermore, he predicted that unless a substantial sacrifice is made by the American people, the nation can expect the further deteriorations of cities, increased antagonisms between races, and continued disorder in the streets. He asserted that people are not informed enough to give adequate support to anti-poverty programs, and he leveled a share of the blame at the government because we must do more to get people to understand the size of the problem. King goes on, and I'm going to wrap up with this part. He says, let us look at the size of the problem through the lens of the Negro status in 1967. He said, when the Constitution was written, a strange formula to determine taxes and representation declared that the Negro was 60% of a person. Today, another curious formula seems to declare that he's 50% of a person. Of the good things in life, he has approximately one half of those of whites. Of the bad, he has twice of those of whites. Thus, half of all Negroes live in substandard housing, and Negroes have half the income of whites. When we turn to the negative experience of life, the Negro has a double share. There are twice as many unemployed. The rate of infant mortality, widely accepted as an accurate index of general health among Negroes, is double that of whites. The equation pushes Negroes even into war. There was twice as many Negroes as whites in combat in Vietnam beginning in 1967. And twice as many Negro soldiers died in action in proportion to the numbers in the population. And the spheres that figure are equally alarming. Elementary schools, Negroes lag 1 to 3 years behind whites, and their segregated schools receive substantial less money per student than do white schools. 1/20th as many Negroes as whites attend college. Half of these are ill-equipped Southern institutions. Of employed Negroes, 75% hold menial jobs. Depressed living standards for Negroes are not simply the consequence of neglect, nor can they be explained by the myth of the Negro's innate incapabilities or by a more sophisticated rationalization of his acquired infirmities, family disorientation, and poor education. They are structurally part of the economic system in the United States of America. You know, I could go on and on in this chapter. I mean, there's so many things that to pull from here. But, you know, I'm winding down. I got 2 minutes left. And, you know, I just want to sort of wrap up. I want you to get the book. I'm going to put a link in here where you can go. And when you go to that link, just click Barnes & Noble's. And if you type in the book, you can be able to pull it up and purchase a copy of the book. And let me type that in real quick right here while I'm talking. And I hope that, you know, you got a lot out of listening to this. I hope you go purchase the book. If you go to www.zamzoo.com/movementsunlimited, click Barnes & Noble's over on the right-hand side. You can order, you can go in and you can pull up the book and order the book. Again, the title of the book is Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? And as I promised you, you know, as we close out here, you know, we want to leave with some hope. You know, we need to read, we need to enlighten our communities and work to make change real and to make sure that our president has our back, you know, and that we have our president's back. President Obama is pushing forward, you know, he has a thin line to walk on. But, you know, I've seen these pictures of people with posters of Obama and King and, you know, Obama being a reflection of the dream. Well, okay, yeah, okay. Again, I tell you what my take on that dream speech. But let's look where did Dr. King, what was Dr. King talking about in the end? He said, again, that it's important to understand that, you know, it didn't take a lot to pass those legislation, but it's going to take a lot to do the things we got to do today. Hey, tomorrow, I haven't decided what time. Tomorrow I'm going to put up Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech and go into that. As you know, Dr. King gave a speech April 4th, 1967, Beyond Vietnam, When Silence is Betrayal, in which he took his stance against the Vietnam War. And 1 year later, April 4th, 1968, on the same exact day he gave that speech in 1967, he was assassinated and taken away from us. So join us tomorrow, and I'll be putting a post up later on today about that. Until next time, this has been Bobby Jahi. God bless you. thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed our show today. And it's time to close out with my theme song, It's My Time.
Enjoyed the Success Songs original composition. For music and words that create powerful moments in your day, go to successsongs.com and hear life from a higher vibration.